So basically, what I want to look at here, so you have the story of Abraham and Sarah, which kind of culminated with Parsha of Chayes Sarah, and the reason that Chayes Sarah becomes this big weekend where everybody descends. I mean, literally, there were thousands and thousands of Jews in Hebron, yes, on Shabbos, Friday and Shabbos, and with massive traffic both coming and going, really more leaving, is because that's when Avram acquired the cave. And it says there, just as a, I'm just going to give you a parenthetical, that when the story goes that when the angels came to Avram to tell him about the fact that he's going to have a son, even though he was told it before that, but here's the official announcement. It says that Avram's preparing the food and he runs after a sheep or whatever it was, and it runs off. And where does it run to? It runs to the cave of Machpelah, and that's how he discovered it. He discovers it as he's running after doing this kindness for these guests that come to his house, and he discovers this place that, and he walks in, and there is Adam and Eve, that they're there. It says that they were in this crypt, and the smell of Gan Eden, of the Garden of Eden, was there. So, like, that was his intro to this place. So that ultimately, when he looks for the burial place for Sarah and for himself, he goes back there. So it's like what the Medrash is basically saying is there's some kind of connection between the angels coming and giving over this prophecy about Isaac being born and tying it to the continuum of Ma'ar to Machpelah, and then it goes into the issue of that there is an issue. There is some kind of, I don't call it contempt, but that Adam and Eve are not so happy. Adam and Chav are not so happy with Abraham and Sarah being buried there, with Sarah being buried there, because in a certain sense, Abraham and Sarah are like, they're the couple that got it right, as opposed to Adam and Eve, which kind of went sideways or negative. But then the Midrashim say that Abraham explains to Adam that no, we're here to make you look good because we corrected the things that you needed correction, and so we actually came to assist, not the other way around. Okay, fine. So now, fast forward to where we are here. So this is really talking about the next generation of Isaac and Rebekah. So we saw in last week's parsha that Eliezer, or the slave of Abraham, goes to find a wife for Isaac, and you see this incredible scene of where Rebekah is like Superwoman, basically giving water to Eliezer, to all these huge camels. And she's just like Superwoman, doing all this good kindness. She's clearly a very special woman, and fit for Abraham's son Isaac. Comes back and it describes for us that basically Rivka is like the replacement for Sarah. It literally, it says it actually. If you look at the word in here, it's right here. Da 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 da. Where is it? Where do we have them going back in there? Okay, so let me take it back one chapter. Okay. One second. So basically, when move this over here. It says that when Isaac takes Rebekah in, let's see here, the wording exactly. Okay, this is, I'm like running through the actual story. Okay.
To his mother's tent.
Right, exactly, right? So it says here, okay, chapter. Okay, that's when this thing gets in the way here. Okay. So it says like this: and Isaac brought her to the tent of Sarah's mother, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted for the loss of his mother. So the idea, the way they explain it, is that it's this idea that she really embodied a lot of, if not totally, what Sarah represented. And this is the idea that she was a comfort, because it says that when she went into this tent, everything that was that had been lost on the death of Sarah came back. And so she really like brought back whatever that incredible power energy that Sarah, what she represented, with Rivka, you know, coming to the family and becoming Isaac's wife, like that all returned. Okay, so now what's interesting, and this is what I want to look at, is the relationship that Rebecca has with her sons, because it's a very, it's almost like the relationship that she has with Isaac. Do they communicate well? Do they not communicate well? You know, there's a lot of strange stuff going on, especially when it comes to the blessings that are given by Isaac to his sons. So it was supposed to be going to Esau, and there's a whole subterfuge, and they trick Isaac, and he gives the blessings to Jacob. Like, what's going on here? And if I were to stop you now and just say, okay, tell me, what do you think? Is Esau a bad guy? And if he is he supposed to get blessed or not? Okay, so what would your reaction be? Knowing the story on its face value, is he a good guy? So the reading ends up becoming that he seems to be a pretty bad guy, or some kind of, not like the person that we're aspiring to, let's just say. But then the question is he supposed to be cut out completely from getting blessed or not? Okay, so that's the question. Okay, and the answer to this question is very important, because what the answer to this question, really the impact of the answer, is really going to be historical in terms of like how we proceed and how we view things. How do we understand Esav, who ends up becoming Rome, which begets us Western civilization? So how do we relate to that? Now, is he supposed to be cut out? Is he supposed to be, you know, completely ignored? Or is he supposed to be integrated? Okay? So on the face of it, the way I always understood it, at least the way it's presented, is that he's really like a bad guy and we don't want to see him at all. We want to kind of push him out the door. But so for some reason, Isaac is, the Torah says explicitly that Isaac favors Esav. So that's question one. Is he supposed to be completely, you know, kind of pushed out of the story, okay? Is he supposed to be not part of the equation? Number two is, okay, so is he a bad guy that we just don't want to see from and like totally cut out? And then the question really is also like, what's going on with Rebecca? And does she want it? Like, I mean, again, it says that she clearly favors Jacob. So does that mean that she has also this attitude that Esav needs to be completely cut out? Or is there something else going on here? Okay. So those are the two. And then again, the ramifications really is what is how I'm saying it, is that for the rest of history, how we relate to Western civilization, because Esav begets us, first he begets us Amalek. There are a lot of things that come out of Esav. Amalek, our worst, most horrible arch enemy, comes out of Esav. Then we have Rome, we have Western civilization. So like, how are we supposed to understand, you know, how do we approach those things based on, and it all starts here. This is really the beginning of this, you know, basically the unfolding of history. And it very much, you know, like for, I'll give you an example. You know, it says that the rabbis in the Talmudic times, that before they went to visit the Romans, and that meant like, you know, going to the powers that be of the time, it would be like going to Washington, D.C., you know, the equivalent of going to Washington, D.C. to meet your, you know, senators and Congress people and the President of the United States. So they would learn, they would study the story of Jacob getting ready to confront Esau. So in that, you know, there's whatever, however Jacob approached that, it becomes something of a kind of a textbook of how one would go and approach the Western civilization. So And that's another discussion for like when we get to that, like what exactly was going on there, the intricacies, the different like little details as to like what it means to us now. Because ultimately, you want to read these things, you want to learn these things, but then what do we take home? What's the take home from it? Okay, so here in today's in this story of Rebekah and Isaac and the boys and Esau and Jacob, what's going down? Like, what's the story here? How do we understand? Ultimately, it's funny. We usually like focus all on Jacob, but where does Esau fall out here? Like, what's the take home? Where does he end up in this story? So let's just read a little bit of the story, and then what I really want to understand is if Rebecca is really seems to be favoring Jacob, what is her attitude towards Esau? Okay, so here's the story. So first, and these are the generations of Isaac, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Betuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to himself for a wife. So fine, so Isaac at 40 years old takes Rebekah as his wife. Now, you would think then, just as the way it intros it, that we're going to be talking about Isaac. But what's funny about it is it kind of like shifts into being Rebekah's story, more Rebekah than Isaac in a sense. And Isaac prayed to the Lord opposite his wife because she was barren, and the Lord accepted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So now, what's interesting is what the rabbis teach us from the wording is that here, as opposed to Abraham who prayed to have a child, here Isaac is praying to have a child specifically with his wife. Opposite his wife is that he prayed, "I only want to have children from this woman." And the Lord accepted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So, like the idea of, you see that in the subtlety of the word, it says that a focus of Isaac on her. I wanted to have a child with this woman. Almost like to say, whereas Abram and Sarah, there was issues there. It took time. It actually says there was only after the death of Sarah that Abraham really like understood that Sarah was the wife with a, capital the wife, as opposed to any other woman. Here it's like to Isaac, this is like understood. And so and the children struggled within her. And she said, "Vatomim kein lama ze anochi? Why am I?" Not why am I like this, but why am I? As if to say, like, why do I want to go on living? If I have, and what it describes is basically as she walked along, when she passed the house of idol worship, her child, with that the there was excitement, that the there was a reaction to that, and then when she'd go past, something that had to do with holy things, that it also reacted. She's saying, "What's going on here? I think I have a child, one child, and that it's really like schizophrenic, right? It's like, it reacts to both, the good and the bad in an equal way. What is going on here? It's like this is a messed up child already." And the Lord said to her, so she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two kingdoms will separate from your innards, and one kingdom will become mightier than the other kingdom, and the elder will serve the younger." So at that point, it's like whatever this was, this answer, so this is enough for her. It's you see, after that, she seems it's almost like the answer to her question, why am I going on? Like an existential, what's life all about? And when she gets this answer, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb," like the idea that there's two different forces, two different kids that are in my womb, then all of a sudden she's like, okay, you don't see any more angst. But she doesn't share this with her husband. And everybody asks the question, why not? Like, what's the story there? Okay? And that's there are people say, oh, their communication was not there. The truth is that we see that there's something about where she comes from, that she does come from a house of where she has a brother that's a Ramai, that he's a trickster, but that she understands in a certain sense that life is like complicated, and it's not straightforward. And this message that she was getting here, she keeps to herself. But ultimately, if you start seeing here, so let's just go over this. Two nations are in your womb. Two kingdoms will separate from your innards, and the king and one kingdom will become mightier than the other, and the elder will serve the younger. So now, how do you understand Rav Yavod Tzair? The elder will serve the younger. So does that mean that that the elder will be subservient? Or that in a certain sense, there's something much deeper here, and that is that the elder, when I say will serve, means something that means that I will assist, that there'll be an assistance, that the elder will assist the younger one. So that, again, when I looked at it and when I understood it growing up, that my approach or understanding was that it was the idea that Jacob would become the one to, and again, would be, you know, and we don't want the second. We don't want the Esav in the picture. But what this is saying very clearly, if you really look closely, what it's saying is when it says the elder will serve the younger, is that these two forces are not one to the negation of the other, but rather the second will assist the other. And that really what we're saying in is that the forces that Esav becomes will be very intricately needed, will be an assist, will help the other to get where they need to get to. So it's you know, like that. This is a big idea, because what we're saying now is we're not looking to negate per se, even though, let's say, for example, Amalek. So that's one we're told we want to negate those forces. But there's other aspect of Esav. What's interesting is that in Chazal, the rabbis in the teachings, there's actually a good Esav and there's the bad Esav. What it means is that there's some energy, there's a power within Esav, which becomes Western civilization, which has aspects that are very important and good and positive, and then there are the negative aspects as well. And so maybe you can say, you know, that this force, what it is, what Esav becomes, is clearly actually a very important force in the history of the Jewish people. And it's going to take us along that the house of Jacob, Beit Yaakov, which becomes Yisrael, is going to very much need to like run parallel to Esau and how he becomes. And that this is not one without the other, but rather, and that's actually what Rivka understands. Rebecca understands at this point that there's a need for both. So that even though she favors Jacob over Esau, as opposed to her husband who has the opposite, the difference is that to Isaac, in a sense, what we see is that he almost has it, it's a zero sum, like I'm going to go with this one over that one, where she understands perhaps differently, that we're going to need both. Okay, so how do I see that? So first we see this in the prophecy. And her days to give birth were completed, and behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first one emerged ruddy. He was completed like a coat of hair, and they named him Esau. And afterwards, his brother emerged, and his hand was grasping Esau's heel, and he named him Jacob. And now Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. Okay? So he holds on to his heel, and Vayikra Shemo Yaakov. What's interesting about that is who named him Yaakov? Who named him Jacob? Any ideas?
Well, it's implied that it's Isaac. Yeah. But it's when it says he, because it's interesting. I never, first it says they named him Esau. I mean, I don't know if the English translation is tracking Hebrew correctly. And then it says he, you know. So for Jacob. It's they for both, for Esau.
Right.
And then it's he for Isaac.
Right? So that's... So I'm not, it's for some reason it's not coming up here. So let me try to pull it up.
Well, the Hebrew was right next to it, isn't it?
Yeah, but I want to show you Rashi. So let's see here. Okay, let me see if I can pull it up. Can you see the screen as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's interesting about this? There's a medical explanation for some of this, actually.
Right.
This is someone I had a neonatologist once described. This is the first description of a twin-to-twin transfusion.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And you ever hear of twins? It doesn't quite match up with what really happens, but there are twins that often one twin steals the blood from the other.
Uh-huh. And that's why one's red. This one becomes redder, right?
Correct. Except right. That twin, who the one who received is the receiver of the blood, is often sicker and weaker because they're plethoric. They have too much blood and they're sicker.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't quite match.
Because here it's going the opposite way, right? So now,
yeah.
So let me show you. So I'll show you here. So it says Vayikra Shmo Yaakov. So the beauty of this is when you read text. And then you have Rashi saying something because Rashi's bothered by the same thing. So he says one is, he says God called him Yaakov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or like you said, Mark, Aviv Karalo Yaakov, Al Shem Achizas HaKev, based on the fact that he was holding on to his heel, he called him Yaakov, which is based on the idea of, in the word of Yaakov is Akev, which is the heel. So he is the guy holding the heel. Okay, but it's interesting that like as opposed to where Vayikra'u, that they, which means probably it might make sense, it would be his parents, right? Here, it's focused on, fine. So back to the text. So now, okay. So what happens? And the youth screw up. And Esav was a man who understood hunting. He was an Ish Yodea Tzayit, Ish Sadeh, a man of the field. Whereas Jacob was an innocent man, Ish Tam, dwelling in tents, which we say is like he was a person who studied Torah, whatever that means at that time. And Isaac loved Esau because his game was in his mouth, Kitzayit Befiv. But Rebecca loved Jacob. So at this time, right, so you get the sense, at least on the surface here, is that, right, so that he, that Isaac loves Esau and gives a reason why. And Rivka loves Yaakov, loves Jacob. Okay, so now, again, it's kind of interesting that you see that the Torah is giving us a reason why Isaac finds Esav, you know, why he loves him, whereas Rivka just loves Yaakov without him giving us a reason. Something about just, okay, fine. So now, Jacob cooked a pottage. So what this is telling us, as we understand between the lines here, he's cooking something that you would normally cook when you're sitting Shiva. Because who passed away? Abraham passed away. It says that they're 15 years old at this time. So that Jacob's sitting there cooking adashim, lentils, and Esav came from the field and he was faint. And Esav says to Jacob, pour into me some of this red pottage, for I am faint, and he was therefore named Edom. So he gets the name Edom, red, from the fact that he wants the red stuff. And so Jacob said, sell me as of this day your birthright. Esav replied, behold, I'm going to die, so why do I need this birthright? Which is bizarre. He's 15 years old, he's talking about dying. So why is he doing that? Like, what's that about? And so clearly, he's bothered by, you know, like something. Perhaps he's reacting to Abraham's death. And like, what's the point of this whole thing? You know, here's, you know, I heard a beautiful idea that it's at this point that Esav kind of like goes off the path, and it's a reaction to his grandfather passing, because Abraham had a certain, like treated him in a way that made him believe in himself, and that after his passing, he like now is saying, what do I need? I'm going, what's life about? It's an existential question, like, what's this all about? What do I need this for? Which, by the way, is interesting because, you know, in a certain sense, it's similar to the way Rebecca reacted when the two boys or the two babies are struggling within her. Like, what do I need this for? You know, this is again, you know, like, what's the purpose of all this? Again, going back to the prophecy for Rebecca, when she was told that there are two forces that are in her. She took that as, and you see that she's, after that, there's no more questions, because for her, she understands that that's a necessary thing for the future of the world, that we're going to need these two forces. And so, And we'll see it coming out with her sons, because even though the Torah tells us just now, it told us that she loves Jacob, whereas her husband Isaac loves Esau because he's got a way with his words, let's just say. So now back to this discussion. Jacob is pining for the birthright, almost as if he understands the beginning of something. I'd start anything because I have a hope for the future. So I want to be connected to the birthright, to the thing of the Bechora, the thing that's the beginning. Birthright, you know, again, the idea of the first. Esau says, what do I need it for? I'm going to die. And so Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. And so he swore to him, and he sold him the birthright, and he sold his birthright to Jacob because he saw no value in it. And Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he ate and drank and rose and left. And Esau despised the birthright. So Esau really is having real issues with the, you know, what's the purpose of all of this, right? So, and that continues through the story. 15 years old, that's what's going on in the house of Isaac, okay? So now, I would call it like a sidebar of where, this is a whole other question, is that Isaac is not allowed to leave the land of Israel. Starts with Abraham when he tells his servant, go find my son a wife from the homeland, but my son can't go with you. He's not allowed to leave. And so to hear, when it comes to, Isaac's going to say, hey, my father went down to Egypt when things got rough over here. I'll go down as well. God says, do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land that I will tell you. So in this one, like the Torah tells us, where the rabbis explain that the reason he's not allowed to leave the land is because he's this holy, like he was put on the altar at the time of the Akedah, and so he can't, he's got a certain sanctity to him, and therefore he can't leave the land of Israel. That's the, but I wanted to try to delve into that a little bit more, not for today's class. I really want to focus on this issue of Esau and Isaac and Jacob and Rebecca, how does she view the world? Okay, so this is going through. God tells him, you know, don't go out. And then you have this whole story where he goes to a place where the king starts up with them, takes his wife. And then this whole issue of the wells, digging wells. Also, interesting things to talk about there, but not for today. Okay. And then, So we see at the end here that Esau was 40 years old. So now, Esau's 40. That means that Isaac is turned 100, because he was 60 when he was born, and he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basmat, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they were a vexation of the spirit to Isaac and Jacob. This caused both Isaac and Rebecca a lot of, you know, they were just not happy. Didn't marry from the right. He married women from the land of Canaan, from Palestine, as opposed to going back to, I guess, the house of Abraham, or let's say Nahor, that, you know, where Rebecca came from, okay? Which we'll see later on is where they send Jacob to find a wife from the house of Laban, okay? But we still focuses on this issue of the blessings, okay? So, and it came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were too dim to see that he called Esau his elder son, and he said to him, my son, and he said to him, here I am. And he said, behold, now I have grown old. I do not know the day of my death. So now sharpen your implements and your sword and take your bow and go forth to the field and hunt game for me. And make for me a tasty foods as I like and bring them to me. And I will eat in order that my soul will bless you before I die. So he wants to bring me something that's going to put me in this proper state and so that I can give you over the blessings. But Rebecca overheard when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son, right? Which is interesting. It's like, you know, the joke about, you know, when your kids aren't behaving well, your children, as opposed to our children, right? So you see this idea that of the subtlety of Esau, his son, and Esau went to the field to hunt game to bring it. And Rebecca said to Jacob, her son, right? So you see this idea again. So like it's lining up to say more that it's one to the negation of the other, that we seem to, even in Rebecca now, we're seeing that. It's her son is Jacob. Behold, I have heard that your father speaking to Esau of your brother, saying. Now that's pretty interesting, right? So now it's his brother. So bring me game and make me tasty foods, and I will eat, and I will bless you before the Lord, before my death. And now, my son, hearken to my voice, to what I am commanding you. Go now to the flock and take for me from their two choice kids, and I will make them tasty foods to your for your father as he likes. And you shall bring them to your father that he may eat, in order that he bless you before his death. And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, whereas I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will touch me, and I will appear to him as a deceiver, and I'll bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing. Now, what's interesting here is that, just as an aside, is that it's not an issue of, it's this is the difference between them, meaning that in all other aspects, they were similar, perhaps. Okay? So that they might sound alike. It's not an issue of that. It's that my father will touch me. That's when he'll realize that I'm not my brother. Okay, fine. And his mother said to him, on me is your curse, my son. Alai kilascha b'ni. Now, what's interesting about this, the rabbis say, you know, this idea of curse, that perhaps is very much like a Kabbalistic idea, but it's interesting to note, is that she is saying something about curse. What's the original curse? Is that of Adam and Eve. That when Adam and Eve ate from the tree, they were cursed. There was curse in the Garden of Eden. Alai kilascha b'ni is saying, perhaps, that what she's saying is that we're addressing these very early issues of the Garden of Eden. It really is talking about humanity. There's ideas that are expressed that Jacob ends up taking on certain aspects of Adam, that he had the special qualities of Adam, his beauty, this incredible, like the rabbis describe it, the Midrashim talk about Adam as like going from one side of the earth to the other, like this incredibly expansive, amazingly unlimited being. And that Jacob had resemblances or represented similarities to Adam. But they, and that, you know, there's stuff like that that we're addressing these early issues of what happened in the garden. Alai kilascha b'ni is making reference to that. The thing is, they say, like, how could it be that if Adam was like what we describe Adam, like Jacob is anywhere near that? And they say the answer is that really we're talking about Adam post the sin. Adam post sin, Jacob had this, even after that, meaning you're starting out with like the most incredible being that ever, was ever created, and then he sins, and he descended from that high level down, but that, you know, from there, you know, still was an incredibly high, lofty level, and that Jacob was on this level that he represented even Adam, and after that, after his dissension, after the sin. Okay, but the idea that there's a struggle that's going on in the garden, that's coming out, that there's stuff that's going on here with the Esav and Jacob issues that is really addressing these early issues, which we'll see. Okay, so he went, and he took, and he brought them to his mother, and his mother made tasty foods as his father liked. And Rebekah took the costly garments of Esav. Now, what were these big day Esav? What were these garments of Esav? So it explains that Esav got these. These were the garments of none other than Adam and Eve. So this is the garment of Adam. So that means that these are the garments that came post the sin. And these are not just your average garments. They were then taken and passed on to Nimrod, which is the basic arch enemy of Abraham. And it was Esav that defeated Nimrod and took these garments. So Esav is holding these garments, and now who does he entrust it with? With his mother Rebekah. So that's why she has the garments, and she there gives it over to her son to go in to trick her husband. Okay, so then she gives the costly garments of Esav to her elder son, which were with her in the house. And she dressed Jacob, her younger son. So now, it's interesting here is because now, in this whole thing that's going on here, it identifies Rebecca, right, and says, Binah HaGadol, Esav, her elder son. And so we start to see that since, like, till now, we see that there's this real favoring of Jacob over Esau, but we'll start to see that there's more, that now they start entering in, okay, it's actually her older son, like it's her son, to her younger son. So that you start to see, if you go back to the prophecy, the elder will serve the younger, right? So in here, you start to see she's taking the elder son and she's giving the garments over to the younger son. Now, in the hides of the kids, she put on his hands and on the smoothness of his neck. She gave the tasty foods and the bread that she had made and into the hand of Jacob, her son. And he came to his father and said, my father. And he said, here I am. Who are you, my son? And Jacob said to his father, I am Esav, your firstborn. I have done as you have spoken to me. Please rise, sit down, and eat of my game so that your soul will bless me. So now, this is always a tricky one because at the end of the day, we all ask the question, how could Jacob lie? How could he present?
Lies.
Right? So that's something that it's actually later on when Jacob comes to Leah and says, how could you have deceived me? And she says, you're the one to talk. Right? Like, you're the one who said you were Esav. Like, you're giving me a hard time that I put myself out as Rachel. I mean, seriously, you know? So, like, clearly, like, when the rabbis show that subtlety in the language over there, clearly what's coming up is that this is not so straightforward. It's not a straight, you know, black and white thing. As they say, it's complicated, right? But he does present himself as his brother, as his mother told him to do. And Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? And he said, because the Lord your God prepared it for me. Now, wait a second. What's strange and what Isaac reacts to is the mention of God. Because then Isaac said to Jacob, please come closer so that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esav or not. Because the rabbis say, that's not how Esav spoke. He wasn't, that's not, that was not his way of speaking, mentioning God. So that's like, what. But again, the subtlety here is what I would say is that what it comes out is that Esav and Yaakov, Jacob, they actually sounded the same. So it wasn't the fact that he heard the voice and said, no, that can't be Esav. But no, actually, they sounded exactly the same. What got Isaac concerned was the fact of how he spoke, not how his voice sounded. Come closer because, right, so something weird going on here. So Jacob drew near to Isaac, his father, and he felt him. And he said, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esav. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like the hands of his brother Esav, and he blessed him. So he gives him the blessing. And he said, are you indeed my son Esav? And he said, I am. Again, made to say, but here he says it, Vayomer ani, I am. As if to say, you know, like he didn't say, I am Esav. He says, I am, you know, like more generic. Okay, fine. So you could, like, you know, give him like a little bit of an out there.
So a loophole.
What?
A loophole.
A loophole, exactly. And he said, serve it to me, then I might eat of the game of my son, so that my soul will bless you. And he served him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. And his father Isaac said to him, please come closer and kiss me, my son. And he came closer, and he kissed him, and he smelled the fragrance of his garments. Now it says here, what is the fragrance of his garments? He smelled the smell of Gan Eden. He smelled the smell of the Garden of Eden. That was the fragrance, because that's where these garments came from. And he blessed him. And he said, behold, the fragrance of my son is like the fragrance of a field which is the Lord has blessed. Now again, if it's the fragrance of the Gan Eden, of the Garden of Eden, these garments, right? So the initial creation of Adam and Eve was without garments. So post-sin, the garments will come to represent a situation of that which was not necessarily the ideal, right? It's like, this is kind of like, after a sin, this is the answer. Not exactly the ideal, but perhaps this is the way we address the issues of post-sin, right? So, like, there's something about these garments. Okay, so then he gives him, and may the Lord give you of the dew. Here's the blessing. may give you of the dew of the heavens and of the fatness of the earth and of the abundance of grain and wine. Nations shall serve you and kingdoms shall bow down to you. You shall be master of your brothers and your mother's sons shall bow down to you. Those who curse you shall be cursed and those who bless you will be blessed. Okay? You hear a little bit of the, you know, the kind of like the blessing at the end there of what Abraham was given from God, that this is being passed over, even though later on we're going to see that the Torah actually, Isaac gives over to Jacob the blessing of Abraham. Like he says, you're the one who's going to take over that legacy. But you hear a little bit of that in there. And also you see this idea of kingdoms of one will bow down, Yavduchamim, right? That they will serve you. So again, in this, now usually you would think like they'll serve you. So you think, okay, they're going to have a lot of slaves. But that's not what it means. Yavduchamim is that they're going to help you. They're going to be important. They'll help you in what you're trying to accomplish. Okay, so that, again, going back to the prophecy that Rebecca got all the way at the beginning, is that the younger, the older will serve the younger. So too here, the blessing that Isaac's giving over is that the one will help the other. And then, and it came to pass when Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and it came to pass that Jacob had just left his father Isaac's presence, that his brother Esav came from his hunt. So now, what we're going to look at in a second is the nature of the blessing that Isaac gives to Esav. And then we have to ask ourselves, how different is the first blessing to the second blessing? So he too had made tasty foods, and he brought them to his father. And he said to his father, let my father arise and eat of the game of his son, so that your soul will bless me. And his father Isaac said to him, who are you? And he said, I am your son, your firstborn Esav. And Isaac shuddered, a great shudder, and he said, who then is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate of everything while you had not yet come, and I blessed him. He too shall be blessed. So it says first his reaction is like complete, like, you know, it's like horror. It says that the ground opened up and he saw, you know, hell basically. He saw Gehenna. And then, you know, because everything is like turned upside down for Isaac. But then once he realizes what's going on, he too shall be blessed. Because it hit him. Okay, wait a second. All right. If what he was convinced of, that Esav should be the one to carry on the legacy, because Esav was the one who confronted the world and all of its, you know, in the physicality and of the world and all that needed to be developed in the physical realm, that he thought for sure that this is not a task for Jacob. But then when he realizes that Jacob is capable of being able to pull this off, then at that point he said, wait a second, he has the resources, he has the potential abilities to be able to deal with this world, he too shall be blessed. When Esav heard that his father's words, he cried out a great and bitter cry, and he said to his father, bless me too, O my father. And he said, your brother came in cunning and took your blessing. And he said, Is it for this reason that he was named Jacob? For he has deceived me twice. He took my birthright, and behold, now he has taken my blessing. And he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? And Isaac answered and said to Esav, behold, I made him a master over you, and I gave him all his brothers as servants, and I have sustained him with corn and wine. So for you then, what shall I do, my son? And Esav said to his father, have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father. And Esav raised his voice and wept. And his father Isaac answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling place shall be the fat places of the earth, and of the dew of the heaven from above. So again, if you go back to the earlier blessing, you'll start to, if we line them up, they're very similar. Because he says, may the Lord give you the dew of the heavens, and of the fatness of the earth, and an abundance of grain and wine. Right? Here we fast forward also, right? He says to him, behold, I made him a master of my father. But he says, okay, behold, your dwelling place shall be of the fat places of the earth and of the dew of the heaven from above. So it's the same blessing, just actually inverted. And you shall live by your sword, and you shall serve your brother, and it will be when you grieve that you will break his yoke off your neck. That when you grieve, you will take off his, right? You'll take off his yoke of his yoke off your neck. So at this point, so what you see here is that they both end up getting very similar blessings, even though it's clearly that one is going to be more of an assistant to the other. And from this reaction, the reaction of Esav is he hated Jacob because of the blessing that his father had blessed him. And Esav said to himself, "Let the days of mourning for my father draw near, and I'll then kill my brother Jacob." Now, Rebekah was told of the words of Esav, her elder son, and she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and she said to him, "Behold, your brother Esav regrets his relationship to you and wishes to kill you. And now, my son, hearken to my voice and arise, flee to my brother Laban to Haran, and you shall dwell with him for a few days until your brother's wrath has subsided. Until your brother's rage subsides from you, and he forgets what you did to him, and I will send and bring you from there. Why should I be bereft of both of you on one day? Why should I lose both of you on the same day?" So you start. So here's where it becomes clear that she understands it's both of them. Why should I lose both of you on Yom Echad, on one day? Is this idea that, and really then go back and you see that through this whole thing, her understanding is that they're both need to, there's a need for Esav and for Yaakov, for Jacob, to work together. And that through history, they're going to be like, in a sense, sometimes Esav is a foil, like we see with Amalek, but other times he's very much like the idea of Western culture is going to be something that's going to be a tremendous assistance. So we say, for example, this is an example further in history, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the one who wrote the Mishnah, had a very close relationship with Antoninus, and that they you know, here's Esav of Rome, and there's Rabbi, which is Jacob, the house of Israel, and they were extremely, extremely close, and they were, you know, clearly like the closeness was that of, you know, in a certain sense, helpmates. And so there are different times where we see that this alignment, because what Rebecca was seeing is that you need to have those these two forces, not one negates the other, but rather in tandem. So that at first her reaction was, we see that she was like, "Why should I even be alive? What's the meaning of life if there's going to have these two forces that literally go counter?" And then when Hashem's answer to her, the prophecy is, no, these are two different forces, and that, you know, one's going to serve the other, one's going to help the other, is that so that we, you know, when we look at, let's say, for example, like the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, the idea is that those forces, you know, that's something that raw force can be taken both for good and for bad. But you need that raw energy that's going to be, you know, now how are we going to take it? So that Esav ends up taking that force and he goes off into history as the builder, creates societies. We talk about Rome building societies of, you know, commerce, of roads, of, you know, that type of thing. So like taking, you know, the world and conquering it and then, you know, making it something that we can we as humanity to go forward in terms of development, running parallel with the house of Jacob. But that at times you'll see that power of Esav definitely is clearly, you know, much stronger than that of Jacob. But what comes out of this is that what initially looks like one that needs to be to the negation of the other, the prophecy that Rebecca gets and the way she plays it out, and the reason she doesn't tell Isaac the prophecy is because she was worried that he would not give Esav a blessing, and that was not what was supposed to happen, but rather it was that Jacob should get the blessing, the quote-unquote, the more prominent blessing, and that he should be the one who's served by the other, but that it doesn't mean that Esav is not taking, you know, into account. And that we see that she says here, "Why should I be bereft of both of you on one day?" Is that Gam Shnei, it's like she sees both as being important. And Rebecca said to Isaac, and then here she then says, okay, I want my son Jacob to go. I want Jacob, sorry, not my son, but rather I want him to go and marry from that, you know, not from here, but to go back to her homeland, basically going back to the house of Abraham. So, but I think that the most important thing here is that it's tricky, because we do see that there are elements of Esau that end up becoming very, you know, to the point of, you know, Amalek, right? So Amalek, you can have the most evil coming out from this place, but you also have a positive aspect of Esau as well that needs to run in tandem with Jacob, that it's not going to be to the negation of, but rather as a helper, so that, you know, and that's really what pops out here is that when we start the parsha, it's Ela told us, yeah, Yitzchak is this is the story of Isaac, but then it ends up talking about Rebecca. It's all about, really, if you think about it, and that the next story that's going to come out is Jacob goes down, and we start to see also how it's Rachel and Leah and Rachel, that they also are, like, you know, playing, and really, you know, our forces in terms of the formation of the future of the Jewish people. But here in this story, like, I think that the most important, like, one of the very important points here is that, again, that kind of the hinting to Alai Kelaf Bini, this idea of making a reference that Rebecca says, the curse will be on me, is referencing back to the curse of the Garden of Eden. But she's understanding, and that way the Chazal, the rabbis understand, is that we're dealing with issues of, you know, of existential, like, what is life all about? What's this all about? Like, the struggle of life, about the idea of integration of the physical realm together with the spiritual realm and these different things. So that's really playing out here in the story, but that what it's almost like there's a story in the Gemara that tells us that first the rabbis went through a whole process to negate the people's desire of being drawn to idol worship. That's something that was so negative that they wanted to negate it completely. And so they did it. And the thing that was lost in the process was the ability for prophecy. So that they said, basically, if it means giving up our ability to have prophecy, we're better off getting rid of this desire, the thing that pull for Avodah Zarah, for idol worship. So then they said, oh, this is good. Let's try to get rid of the desire for our sexual impulses we'll call it the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. So they do that, and then basically a couple of days go by, and there are no eggs being laid. So the idea is that that's not something you can get. This is this world, you can't get rid of that. This is one of the things that basically helps the world continue. So, but that, you know, that energy, that force is the desire for developing societies and building and creativity, and all these things come from that. So to get rid of that, no, not possible. But the idea of what we're seeing here, the idea of the melding of a Jacob together with Esav and those forces, is that Esav, and the good and the bad of it also, the foil that of Amalek that comes out of Esav, is going to be the thing that helps propel the Jewish people to become what we are, have become over history and the development of us as a people, in all the good and bad, whatever. But the idea is that this is going to be a continual type of thing, that there's going to be this struggle, and there's ups and downs between the two, but that they clearly are going to run parallel to each other throughout history. And the one who sees that and gets it is Rebecca. And she, in a certain sense, not in a certain sense, she manipulates things in that way so to ensure that that's exactly what happens. And that this is really addressing, in a certain sense, like the struggles of humanity going back all the way to the Garden of Eden. Right? So, like, you know, how do we integrate these things post eating from the tree? Like, how do we, you know, we internalize what it basically said, and before the eating of the tree, there was objective truth. But post the eating, when we internalize these drives, so then we always are going to be struggling with, you know, these elements of these different forces. But the idea is that through this, you know, what's happening here in Rebecca's womb, and then ultimately when they're born, and then they go out into life, is that they're going to be this need to really somehow bring these forces together. They work together. They work parallel. They work against, in many ways. And like even internally, we all internally have these struggles where we have these different forces within us. And so this is really like represented by what's going on here. And so that, you know, when we recognize it, so I heard a beautiful idea this week from Rabbi, I think it was Mark Penner, or maybe his wife, I'm not sure which one said it, but they were talking about different struggles that come up in life. And so a lot of times we think that when these struggles come up, it's kind of like, it's a detour. It's not really where we're supposed to be. It's kind of like off the path. And the answer really is that when these things come up, it is where we're supposed to be. That's not the side, but it's actually where we're supposed to be. It's not some detour, but rather we're right exactly where we're supposed to be. And so I think that like what's being described here, these different forces of, you know, of the Jacob Esav story is really, it's as much, you know, today as it's always been. You see like how we have, let's say, the Torah values and the Western values, and they don't necessarily work together. But the idea is that that struggle between the two forces, the idea is that we're supposed to struggle. But through that struggle, we're going to come out to a better place. We're able to develop ourselves, become through those struggles. And from that, it kind of like propels us towards like where, you know, we're supposed to be going. So through the struggle, it ultimately gets us to the truest meaning. And so that's kind of like, you know, you see it here. It was going on in Rebecca's womb, comes out two different people, and those two people come representative of two ways of paths in life. Sometimes they work together and sometimes they clash, but ultimately they need each other. They need each other to be able to get, to develop, to go forward and to become that much more of what they're supposed to get to.
So you're saying it boils down to it's always the journey, not the arrival.
Correct, correct. And it's a struggle. It's this eternal struggle that exists. Yeah.
Is this, I mean, it seems to me like you're talking, you know, along the lines of this being really two sides of the same, like, you know, coin, in the sense that it's like, and I sort of analogize it to like the body and the soul, like the, you know, Jacob being more the spiritual, you know, Esau being the sort of the physical, and that you can't really have one without the other. You, mm-hmm. you know, you have, in order to achieve the spirituality and the values, you have to have the body and the physical to carry it around and actually execute and to do what, you know, needs to, you know, sort of actualize the spiritual.
Correct, correct. So. But what's interesting is that they're twins, right? They're really coming from, they're almost like they were attached to each other. They're really part of the same, and then they split out. Only, you know, like, the fact is that you have so much, you know, it, like in life, there's so many things that contradicts the other, and makes us wonder, like, what's it all about? You know, that's really what Rivka was saying, like, Lama Zanuchi, what do I, like, what the heck? And also, Esav's coming in, he's saying, like, I'm about to die. What do you mean you're dying? You're 15 years old. Like, but you have people at 15 years old, they're like, why am I alive? You know? So, like, you have this struggle. Like, how do we, like, make it all kind of work together? Especially because the force doesn't, they don't seem to, there is this, it's like, this really doesn't go together. This doesn't really mesh. Like, you're saying the body-soul thing. It's like, doesn't really always work, you know? So, like, we try to make it work, and when it does, it's like, great, this is awesome, you know? But it's just interesting to see, like, the net of this is that it's not the negation of Esav. That's the takeaway from this, is that Rebecca is, like, cognizant of the two sons. It's not one and not the other. She definitely has a love for, and she's clearly like favoring one over the other, as the other, you know, goes both ways, with the Isaac favoring Esav for different reasons. They have different agendas, but ultimately she is the one who sees it's, meaning it's almost like Isaac, she was worried about is having one over one as opposed to the other, and for her it was always about both. It was always in that. And it comes out at the end.
God told her that. I mean, God.
Correct.
Like, it came directly from the source.
Yeah. But
told that the younger will, the older will serve the younger.
Yeah, what's interesting is maybe because of where she came from, the complexity of life for her, coming from the house of Lavan, which everything was always complicated. You know, there's nothing straightforward with that guy. He's always, coming up with a reason, nothing's what it's supposed to be, So from that world that she came from, she could understand this, whereas Isaac maybe not so much. And so therefore, when she heard the prophecy, she understood. She meets him, has a very strong reaction. She falls off the camel, she covers it. Like, she has a very strong, like, he's clearly very, inspiring person, but in that, from the world he's come from, there's something that maybe doesn't have the capacity to be able to handle this duality, Whereas she gets it and therefore keeps that close to her, really keeps it to herself, but then makes sure that it plays out, It's very interesting. It's an amazing story. But then when you look at it from this perspective, you see historically how we as a people have really like chugged through along, maybe always not always getting taken care of so nicely by the Roman, the Western culture, like we've been, stepped on and struggled and beaten and persecuted, etc. But that also on the flip side, you have these forces that have propelled us to where we are now, So it's interesting.
I also think that it's extraordinarily challenging, it's challenging for the mother to recognize differences in their kids. And to recognize that one is going to be different than the other and will favor. Like, how do you favor one over the other? On your family level,
basically what we're looking at, they understand what's amazing about, like, I'm in Hebron, right? I'm at the Maarat HaMachpelah, right? So I'm standing there and I'm feeling like an amazing, like a very strong connection to Abraham. Like, this is my, even though they're all there, but because I guess of the parshas of the week, I'm like been thinking about Abraham and Sarah. Like, that's like my, but basically here are these people. The reason that they're so amazing is that they, in their lifetime and in the way they approached life, they understood, I think, intuitively that they were laying the groundwork for history. And everything they did, so like Rebecca here, in like what she's doing, she understands, she laid the groundwork for this incredible like parallel of these two societies, these two approaches to the world, and that they're going to need to work together. They're going to need to like be a foil for each other, and that they're going to play off of each other throughout history. And it's so important for the history of the world that this happens. But they
also that she recognized for the that in the. For the greater good, she's willing to then play favorites. In a sense.
That's because it's not even playing. It's like, this is what needs to be done, Like,
I know.
It's like the stakes are so high, right? This goes well, we're in good shape. If this goes off a little bit, we got problems, Houston, we got problems, right?
And Hugh, I think you bring up an interesting point, but I think as parents, we know that each of our children has certain strengths, but we're proud of them at different times. Like, one of my daughters was more athletic, and so when that strength came out, I was proud of her at that moment. My pride for that physical strength, swelled. And then my daughter is a PhD, and she was excelling at that moment. It moved in that direction, but
yeah,
so they have different. They're all unique. Not one of my three daughters is exactly the same, and it's amazing.
Of course. I see that with my own kids as well. Yeah.
I think it's amazing. They grew up in the exact same environment, and yet they grew in such amazingly different directions. But it's so interesting. If you say to your, which child do you love the most? You're like, you can't make that distinction, and yet at moments you'd be like, right now you feel like maybe I'm. Right now, my pride is swelling in this area. It's really interesting.
Right, but in this scenario, we're saying it's not even like favoring as much as understanding. Here's which I want to direct this, in a certain direction. So that's what we're doing here. It's interesting is that just to this point of what Eric's talking about, it says that when Jacob blessed his kids, In some cases, he was rather harsh. But what's interesting is the reason, in a sense, they were blessings, is because what he was really telling each child is, I understand you. And each one understood. Yes. Like, if to be understood by a parent is the greatest blessing for the child, you know? It's an interesting, you know, like, they get me, you know, that kind of thing. But here, just in terms of what we're saying here, is that it was very practical. Like, she's looking at this and saying, this is big stuff. This is important. This needs to be going in a certain direction. So we see also, like, you know, in a certain sense, yeah, I think that we have to realize, like, you know, if you read, like, I'm going through Nefesh HaChaim now, and his message there, one of the messages, very powerful, is that everything we do has ramifications that we can't even really fathom how powerful we each individually are in terms of the impact it has on the world, both in the physical realm and in the spiritual realm. So, like, that's, you know, we should be.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm beginning that as well.
Yes,
head is swelling.
But the idea, like, you know, what they're doing here is like they're this is like, you know, major like ramifications for the history. Like, she's laying out, you know, and what she's doing here is like for the history of the world is like she is the foundation, another foundation stone in terms of how history will play out, and we see it's played out that way based on because she did what she did here. It's an amazing thing. Like, these are people that are. We stand on the shoulders of giants. That's really what it's about. So that, like, right. You know, like, when we go back and look at these stories, it's like, wow, you know, like, and they understood, they recognized, they had an intuition that they were laying the groundwork for the history of the world. It's amazing. All right.
Yes.
All right. Listen, have a great week.
You too. Thank you so much.
Stay warm.
You're going to have an Israeli Thanksgiving?